You're listening to Power Athlete Radio, a podcast dedicated to empowering your performance every damn day. Join former NFL pro and Power Athlete founder John Wellborn as he dissects the greatest minds in strength, conditioning, and more. So whether your goal is to be the hammer, destroy mediocrity, or simply move the dirt, you've come to the right place. Now with the warm-up done, let the gains begin.
Hey, Power Athlete Nation, we have a hard-hitting podcast today with Dr. Peter Tierney. Peter is from Ireland and coached rugby as a strength and conditioning performance specialist in the pro leagues of Irish rugby, but also worked in down in London and in the UK with soccer, and in a sense moved on to a more conventional role with a sportswear apparel company where he's a director of performance. But interesting podcast. I'm really fascinated by how he developed rugby athletes, and more importantly, the demands. As an American football player, and here in America, we tend to be very siloed in what we do. But I've always been a fan of rugby as a sport that I never was exposed to until obviously I went to college and it was too late, but one I always wished I'd played. My brother got a chance to play, and I know he loved it. So understanding the demands of training those pro athletes, what it takes to develop them, and then also moving into soccer, which is a very different version. You know, obviously both played with the ball, but you know, the demands are very different. The athletes are very different. The skill sets are very different. And then obviously moving into his new role as a director of sports science. So great conversation and a cool one. And so buckle up for this hard-hitting podcast with Dr. Peter Tierney. What's your PhD? And I, you know, I saw the doctor attached to it, and health and performance coach, sports scientist, and researcher. Did all that really steep within rugby and soccer? And then you've since branched out and now doing other things?
Yeah. So the PhD was in like sports science and rugby union predominantly. So I started the PhD, did all of my data collection in the rugby team that I was working in, and then finished it whilst I was working in soccer. So it was on, I guess, like a novel insights into like maximizing performance in rugby. So there were elements of, I guess, like different training modalities or like interpreting some data as well. So we did some research on resisted sled sprints to try and increase momentum in rugby, try to analyze a lot of like the collision aspects of the game as well, because we felt that they were not more important than the running, but needed more emphasis placed on them compared to some of the conversations that were happening around like running and speed.
You know, I played in the NFL, so I come from American football, but have always been a fan of not only rugby, but the constant nature of it. You know, American football, 5 to 7 seconds, you know, and you might do that 3 times, you might do it 18 times, and you're going to do it over 3 hours in these kind of short little micro bursts. Whereas, you know, rugby is this kind of burst, kind of jog, like continuous movement. So it's interesting to see that the guys are equally as big, but yet have an incredible aerobic base to be able to play at that level for as long as they have.
Yeah, it's cool now to see there's some rugby players that are obviously trying to make it into the NFL. I'm always curious to see how that happens. Like, I think there's some specialist positions that, you know, unless you played it from a young age, it's just going to be difficult. But there's a couple of players now that are going to try to do it. So I'd also love to see a couple of football players from America go into rugby as well, which does happen in the States, but it's cool to think that some people are going to try to do both.
Well, the farther you get away from the ball, like at the line of scrimmage, the farther you get away from the ball, the less inclined you have to be to football, if that makes sense. Yeah. So, you know, when you go out to the receivers and the DBs and those guys, I mean, they're just out there trying to out-athlete each other. When you get closer to the ball, there takes like a certain level of football knowledge. But, you know, that big dude who plays for the Philadelphia Eagles or left tackle was like, you know, 6'8", you know, 380. I think he's a rugby guy. And I think he's from Australia. Is that? Yeah, he's Australian. I mean, he's adapted really good just because it's pretty basic. Like, go back and don't let anybody get past you, you know? I mean, if you're a pretty good athlete, you figure it out. And I saw that there was another rugby player that just got signed by the Kansas City Chiefs that just tried out, and he got signed into training camp for Kansas City Chiefs.
Oh, cool. Was that a Welsh guy? Because I know there's one guy, Louis Rees-Sammet, who's a Welsh rugby player who's trying to make it in the NFL.
Let me look this up, because this was actually kind of neat. Yeah, the guy is Chiefs assigned former rugby star Louis Rees-Sammet.
Yeah, that's him. Oh, yeah, nice. Oh, this can't, okay, you got awesome.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah,
I hadn't heard if he'd signed yet. So yeah, he's a young guy who sort of, I don't want to say did it all in rugby, but like unbelievably skillful and like physically just so fast, strong as well. So I saw earlier a couple of months ago, yeah, he had announced he's going to try make it in the NFL. So cool to see he's been signed. Yeah, awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it really just comes down to, and this is something that I always wondered about, the collisions in football. I mean, I know there's huge collisions in rugby, but when you all of a sudden start packing on a 6 to 8 pound weapon over your head, where now you can use this as like a battering ram and like a third fist is what I used to call my helmet. I wonder how like the impacts, and more importantly, like, because this is wild. Like, I always meet people that when I was playing, they'd be like, oh man, I would die if I took one of those hits. How do you guys take those hits after that? And I was like, well, I took those hits when I was little. And then it was this progressive overload. Like, as I got bigger, everybody else got bigger and the hits got more violent. So there was this kind of progressive overload, almost Milo's bowl in a lot of ways. So by the time you get there, you're 300 pounds, you've been taking these hits for years. It doesn't seem out of the ordinary. I can't imagine not having done that and then strapping on that helmet and having a dude who's, you know, IQ of 4 come in there and just fucking cement block your head. It's going to be cool. I mean, but I have seen some pretty amazing football players and some athletes go play rugby 7 and, you know, they just put those guys on the outside, pitch them the ball and let them jet down the field.
Yeah. US and even some other like nations have had some amazing just athletes jump into 7s. And that's even, I even see 7s as a completely different game to 15s in rugby. So like a full like kind of, or what we're talking about. And so it's cool. Even some players have gone from rugby 15s to rugby 7s, and they found it very difficult and stuff, because even in that sense, there's only 7 people on a full size pitch. So the demands from a running perspective are so different to what people would experience in rugby 15s, and definitely in football as well.
So how do you assess guys? I mean, I imagine there's a, you know, forgive my ignorance on it, but I imagine there's a massive farm system where, you know, players play at a pretty high level growing up through school, and then they get into probably some semi-pro, and then, you know, there's a, like a maturation process into the professional. But when do you guys start evaluating people? And more importantly, when you bring them to evaluate, like, what are the characteristics? I mean, obviously they have to have a high intrinsic knowledge of the sport and being able to do it. I mean, just watching rugby, like, you know, those guys are so perceptive on where the ball is going to go and where it's going to come out and what direction and who takes who. So I always wonder, like, how does that kind of selection process work? We interrupt this episode with a shameless self-promotion. Are you a field or court sport athlete looking to dominate the leaderboard? Let me introduce you to FieldStrong. Take your inner athlete to the next level by exposing yourself to the advanced training techniques that contributed to my 10 years in the NFL. Unlock pinnacle performance and level up your athletic potential today. Head to powerathletehq.com/FieldStrong and claim your 7-day free trial. Now back to the show.
Yeah, I mean, I can probably speak just to the organization that I did work in rugby, because I think every organization will have a slightly different, maybe like talent identification process or profiling system. But Leinster, where I was based in within the Irish rugby system, they would have underage teams starting from probably under 15, 16s, usually just like summer squads. So obviously guys and girls are in school or whatever. So they'll play for their schools within that system. There's a relationship, and it's getting stronger, and it is quite strong now, between the schools and the sort of like underage systems and the sort of senior professional system. So that's definitely one of the really cool things about Leinster anyway, is that from, I don't want to say from top to bottom, but from senior right the way through to schools, so there's certainly an, like, there's a visible path, I think, for a lot of players. Like, they can see that, one, a lot of players prior to them have made the same journey that they're hoping to make. So they've gone from playing for their schools in like a senior cup final. And then before they enter sort of high school, or when they exit high school, before they enter university, the under 19s, 20 squads, they tend to be what we would call like sub-academy. And they have an opportunity then to get into the Leinster Academy. And that's usually somewhere between like 18 and 24 years old. You'd have guys that are there for up to 3 years. And then in between that time, sort of they're trying to get to a physical standard and a technical standard to make sure they're ready for like senior rugby. So alongside all of the coaches, in terms of like, I mean, there's a lot that goes into this, because there's also like positional needs. So if the senior systems know, they can forecast, okay, in these certain positions, we need players. Like, who are the players in schools that we think in 3 or 4 or 5 years time will be fulfilling those or challenging for those positions? And then obviously the physical sides, the physical sort of aspects come in with that as well. So the systems or the measures, I guess, even the exercises we use, we'll try, you're basically trying to get players to be competent and proficient in those movements, so that when they get to academy senior level, they're just like expressing strength and expressing fitness. So they're used to all the technicalities. So whether that's like a box squat variation, like chin-ups, all the sort of like standard core strength elements, they're certainly used along with speed. And then like you mentioned at the start as well, like aerobic fitness is a key aspect for pretty much every position in rugby because they got to play for 90 minutes.
Yeah, no, I'll let you in on a secret. I thought building an aerobic base and I thought aerobic fitness was complete fucking bullshit. During my NFL career, I figured if I lifted heavy weights and I used compensatory acceleration and I could do plyos and jump and sprint, like that was the only energy system I needed to train. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize how wrong I was until after the fact. That, you know, a big aerobic base allows you to recover faster in between plays. I mean, allows for greater longevity. I mean everything from mitochondrial density. I mean, the I'm almost embarrassed a little bit that I didn't put more stock in it and I didn't do more of it. I mean, I try to get at least 30 minutes on one of the modalities we have, whether it be the echo bike or the rower, or pushing the sled or training. I try at least 4 or 5 days a week. It's usually two on, one off, and mixed in with my strength training 4 hours. And, you know, if I got 30 minutes, I jump on the bike and like, you know, basically figure out what my heart rate zones are and try to train, like use, you know, whether it be an Apple Watch or a Morpheus or something in there to try to, you know, maximize it. And, as I've gotten older, not only does my strength not fall off as much, but my ability to be able to do repeated efforts heavy is dramatically better than it was. So I think I had like youth and strength and stupidity on my size, and now that I or on my side, and now that I've gotten older, and it's pretty wild. Like whenever I got a younger NFL player showing up next week, and one of the first things I'm going to put him in is try to beat the hell out of him in terms of building an aerobic base. I mean, just the fact that I can carry. You know, I got my DEXA done and it was like 133 pounds of muscle on the in-body thing. And like the lady was like freaking out. I'm like, I don't know. I lift weights. I eat pretty high protein diet. I don't overeat and I do all my aerobic work, but the aerobic stuff seems to, I mean, I don't know. Like it blows me away that it was such, I was so against it for so long and thought it was so stupid, but I feel like the research is so much better now in the last 10 years than it was, where I just wasn't something that I necessarily popped on my radar.
This episode of Power Athlete Radio is powered by Train Heroic, the most immersive strength training app experience on the market. We've built an online training business by partnering with Train Heroic to deliver all of our world-class training programs like Jack Street, Hammer, Field Strong, and Grindstone. To learn which Power Athlete training program best suits your goals, head to powerathletehq.com/training. And if you're a coach looking to build a business with the best training tech in the business, head to trainheroic.com/powerathletehq. And now back to the show.
Definitely. Yeah. Like, I mean, I think a lot of people have that same reflection. And it's good that like, you know, you can try not change the narrative, but just like educate people now on like the actual benefits for it. But yeah, often people think that just because you're not running around for like 40, 50, 80 minutes, that it's like, oh, well, I don't need aerobic fitness. But the point that you said, just on being able to recover between bouts, like in NFL or even in between sessions, if you train twice, like, so that aerobic system is going to help with, like you said, turning around recovery faster. And I think a lot of people have been guilty of that. It certainly isn't just in one sport. So yeah, hopefully just people are more aware of the benefits now.
Well, the, especially in the NFL, I mean, like you think about like big bodies, it's a very, I guess you could say it's so specialized, especially offensive and defensive line, right? You got these big bodies just moving as fast as they can, you know, within a, you know, basically a 3 foot, you know, 3x3 box. And, you know, guys can almost, you know, be strong enough, have enough aerobic capacity to be able to survive and then kind of play into it. And then, yeah, it just, and then, you know, for the most part, most of the guys are anywhere from 22 or 21 up until maybe 30, 32. I mean, there's players that are older now. You know, when I, towards the end of my career, I remember I was 29 and then I had my birthday and I turned 30 and it was as if like I grew two heads. Like it was the weirdest thing. I'm like, no, I was 29 like a week ago. Now I'm 30. And it's like, oh, like you might as well go out to pasture. So I think the Tom Brady's and the Aaron Rodgers and some of these older guys have really kind of showed that, you know, these guys have developed as long as they've taken care of themselves. So I feel like there's a better piece, but yeah, I wonder if it was the advent and really just the arising of different wearables, whether it be HRV and ways that people could track it with, you know, either a watch or a ring. I mean, I got a way to track my sleeping in a 8 sleep bed and now it gives me my HRV. I mean, it's pretty interesting. Like now I have all these metrics. I mean, the only way that I would ever track anything was we had, they're not called torqueometers, but they, I would check grip strength.
Yeah.
So I check grip strength, and that's kind of how I can kind of measure my recovery. If my grip strength was within my all-time best, within, you know, 5 or 10%, I was fine. If it was way off, I knew I was under recovered. You know, whether it be box jumps or moving the weight or just, you know, how you slapped. I mean, like there were other ways to do it, but I feel like now you can kind of quantify stuff. Like if I don't do my aerobic work, my sleep numbers are off. Like I don't get as much deep sleep. I don't get as much REM. I look at like, you know, the sweet, you know, the quality of that. And it's one of those things where it's kind of a non-negotiable. Like for me, it's about 4 out of every 7 days. I got to get at least 30 minutes. And that's not like 30 minutes of riding. That's like 30 minutes at my target heart rate. So if it takes me 5 to 10 to get there, I got to ride for 40.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of the technology has just evolved to the point that it's just giving access to like to people have access to data that they usually would have had to go to a lab or a physiologist to actually gather. And so I think most of the technology now, like overall, is net positive. I still think there's elements that people misinterpret. And so the benefit of having to go to a lab is that you have somebody who's like an exercise physiologist who's qualified to help you interpret the data. And I had a conversation with somebody recently about this, that, you know, in sport, we do a lot of like force play testing. So that's Ken Rubin jumping, or it's like isometric mid-thigh pull, squat, like the list goes on. But we wouldn't expect an athlete to interpret and analyze their own force plate data. So when now the access they have to wearable data, HRV or total sleep time, whatever it is there. But I still hope that they're, you know, having conversations with their coaches about that, because at the end of the day, the coach is the people who can help interpret and properly make sure that, you know, they take the right action as opposed to taking an action based on something that might not even be accurate from some of those. So certainly I do think the technology and having access to that will help. I think the way I think of it is, you know, having data points like HRV, but even also just like soreness, it might even still be grip strength. That's still a good predictor of even like mortality risk, for example. So, you know, the things that maybe have been used in the past that are still valid, they're the ones that you should definitely still be doing, because, you know, that hasn't been replaced by anything in my eyes. But it's more so trying to take a well-rounded picture. Okay. So it's not relying on like one specific metric too much, because say, for example, in the grip strength example, if your grip strength is always good, but then your resting heart rate is off the charts, or you're sleeping 3 hours a night, you know, they're the other things, or you just feel like your motivation to train is awful. So I think for me, it's always like these wearables are added into a sort of a suite of a few different things that you're tracking long term. You mightn't make adjustments every single day based on the information, but at least, you know, over those medium to long term trends, you can start to say, okay, like these are the behaviors or habits that are positively influencing these markers of health or performance for me, and then these are the negative ones.
With the rugby athletes, I mean, they wear some form of pedometer, I would imagine, so you can kind of gauge. I know when we went down to Australia and worked with the Aussie Rules guys, I mean, some of those guys were running 5 and 10K in a game, and they were at least matching that in practice, which was completely blew my mind. That they were, one, they were running that much, but two, that they were actually recovered enough to not only go train, but then they actually had more endurance work that they had to do in their training. I mean, the most ass backwards thing. Like, hey, you're going to do nothing but 3 sets of 8 to 12 reps. You're going to go out and you're going to, you know, for your speed work, you're going to run 4s and 600s and 800s. And then on practice, you're going to run maybe 3K. In a game, you're going to run 5 or 10. I mean, I was like blown away that this was, you know, their training method, but it's kind of a volume kind of deal for those guys, just because that's, you know, the Aussies are, you know, pretty durable, tough people by nature. So that's, you know, they kind of gravitate towards whatever the more difficult stuff is.
The technology we used in rugby and what I did my master's in is used across like soccer, AFL, and like a lot of other sort of like field sports. So I mean, similar idea to a smartwatch that a lot of runners and even general population will use for tracking, like, you know, distance and run and pace and cycling. There's just a smaller unit that just got like a lot of athletes wear in the back. So if you're watching field sports in rugby, soccer, you'll see like a small sort of, it's smaller than a phone, but like a little bit thicker, and you'll see it in between their shoulder blades. And that's collecting a lot of GPS based data, but also like accelerometer data. So a lot of the research I've done has been involving those. That's going to give a precise and valid measure of like top speed. It'll also give like distance within, you know, it might be like walking speed, high speed running, or like sprinting distance. It'll give you some acceleration, deceleration efforts. And also some of the validation work that we did was on like collision aspects, because obviously some of those rugby guys are doing, you know, they might have 20 tackles in a game and there's no distance accumulated necessarily in those, but the fatiguing cost of those is extremely high. And you know, that was some of the research that we did. We looked at, you know, as competition level increases in rugby anyway, people assume that like the intensity increases, and that is true, but not necessarily for all variables. So people think that the game is like faster from a running perspective, but the data that we saw was actually, it was the opposite of that. It was actually a slower game from a running point of view, but the collision intensity was much higher. So there was more collisions and the intensity of those collisions is higher. And the interesting thing about rugby, and I think this applies 100% to NFL and basically any other contact sport, is that the contact demand of a sport is energetically demanding. So there's some research that I wasn't involved in it, but a group in the UK did. They looked at the energetic cost of, I think, the addition of 20 tackles, and that increased caloric expenditure by, I think, on average, 1,200 calories. And you think in a game of rugby, you might have 20 tackles, 10 carries, you might hit 30. So that's, you know, that's 50, 60 collisions already in one game. You do some in training. So you just think about like the nutritional demand and the energetic cost on some of these contact athletes. Like, that's relevant, not just to rugby, across like every contact sport. And it's a big consideration for people to take into account, I think.
Yeah, no, I was laughing because this morning on the radio, they were talking about, you know, the two most famous people in the world, Travis Kelce and Taylor, Taylor Swift. My mental block on her name for hearing it so much. But I guess they were on vacation and they took pictures, and Travis Kelce was out there and they were calling him Dad Bod, and he was looking like, and I guess he's weighing like 282, which for a tight end is fucking huge. And they were like fucking ripping on him. And as my wife and I were sitting there talking about it, I'm like, you don't realize the physical demand of not only calories and all these other things while you're playing, and like you said, collisions and practice. So you can eat a certain amount, and then all of a sudden the off season comes and you go take a couple weeks off, and it's not like all of a sudden you could curtail your eating. And so now he's bulked up to like 280 and was looking a little soft, which to my least, so he won a Super Bowl. He can do whatever he needs to do. But it was funny that they were trying to shame him on the radio. And I was like, first of all, you guys have never played this game. You don't know what the physical demands are. But like, the fact that dude can't even go on vacation, he's got to get ridiculed in a bathing suit. But 282 is big. Like, I played with a guy named Jason Dunn, who was the biggest tight end I'd ever seen. And JD was like 285. You know, he's going to probably listen. If he listens to this, JD, I'm sorry. But I mean, in the offseason, he was 300 pounds. He's the biggest tight end. I mean, Tony G was never more than, you know, 258, 260. So the fact that he's a 282 pound offseason tight end is big, dude. But yeah, I mean, but people don't factor that in, that like there's a caloric expenditure, or more importantly, there's demands from taking those hits. And on top of it, it's just, it's such a conditioning thing. It's like boxers. You know, you just get to the point where you take it and it just becomes part of what you do. Like, how do you manage, you know, I mean, obviously you guys are measuring all the rugby stuff, but then like, it's probably very position specific. So I always wonder, you know, and this is probably just my own, like, man, I wonder if I could do that. I always look at like the guys that play like the props and the fours and like the frontline guys, like what's the average kind of amount of like volume of running that those guys would do within in a game versus the guys on the outside?
Yeah, it's like, great question. Very, very position specific. And, you know, like you mentioned, even in NFL, there's like, they're almost playing a different sport is how I would describe it. Like, some of the guys who are scrummaging are playing a completely different game to our fullback and wingers, because it's a completely different sport. But depending on the minutes that they play as well, like now what you'll see in rugby is that like substitutes are playing an even more important role, not even more important role, but like a more prominent role in terms of even just duration. So, you know, players, particularly in the front row, so two props and a hooker, three positions, the front row in rugby anyway, you have to have a substitute for each of those positions on the bench as well. So often you'll see like some of those guys, because it's so, so fatiguing, they're holding, you know, like isometric or really, really high force contractions in scrums, mauls, rucks, they're tackling and they're running around as well. So they have it hard. You know, they may be substituted after 50 minutes, for example, and then those substitutes come on for 30 minutes. And, you know, that's sort of a tactical thing as much as a fitness thing. Now, there are some props who are unbelievably playing, you know, 79, 80 minutes for consecutive weeks. And there's a guy in Ireland who, like, who does that most weeks. And that's, like, to me, unbelievably impressive. And he's still maintained an exceptionally high level of strength doing that as well, which is, like, even more remarkable. So, yeah, definitely are, like, different demands. In terms of running, like, some of those, the positions that will do most running might be, like, the fullback or the scrum half. They could do up to, like, 10K, if not a little bit more sometimes in a game. But some of those front rows or type five may only do 5 or 6 or 7K. I don't say only, because a lot of their work is less oriented towards, like, larger distances, but they'll do a lot of short, sharp acceleration, decelerations. And they can be even more fatiguing than some of the sort of, like, linear running as well. So the conditioning piece in rugby in particular, but I think across all sports, is pretty fascinating and is very interesting to navigate.
Have you ever thought about why, for some reason, the best rugby players come from islands? I know this is a totally obscure question, but, like, I was watching some clips in prep for this, and they were showing, like, the Tongan and the Fijians and the Samoans and the New Zealanders, Irish, and, you know, even the guys in the UK. And I was like, what is it about islands? You know, I mean, but then I guess you could say South Africa is pretty dominant, but for the most part, most dominant rugby clubs, man, I'm sure we got Australians listening to this and going to be pissed about it, but I mean, the New Zealanders and the Pacific Islanders, fucking dominant. Like, I was watching one guy from Fiji that looked like he had legs that looked like cement blocks, and he was just killing people. And now, yeah, I think that those guys are, you know, bred for war in a lot of ways. I mean, like, they are absolute, you know, like, warriors in that sense. But, man, it was cool to watch these guys, like, big dudes, get in the open field and just be like, hey, I'm either going to shake this guy or I'm going to run through his neck. And then the other wild thing is there were other guys that looked kind of unassuming, or more importantly, like, not necessarily what you would, like, classify as athletes, that were, you know, like, just looking at them, they kind of maybe look like they won a contest, but were moving extremely well and were fucking laying huge hits and had the ability to generate force. So it's pretty exciting to see a sport that's played. I mean, you know, the NFL, it's kind of bullshit. And then they're like, oh, world champions. Well, they only play it in the US. So how the fuck can you be a world champion? And that was always my thing. And, like, that was just a marketing thing that they pulled out. But something like, when you look at rugby, where all of these countries, and decidedly, I mean, America tends to, you know, there's other sports that are extremely valuable outside of rugby. You know, you get to go play in the NFL, and, you know, it's why a lot of these sports are kind of falling by the wayside, because people can go make more money. But I always wondered, I was like, what is it about islands? Like, that's a interesting, I don't know, observation that I don't think anybody's been able to quantify.
The island theory. I haven't researched or thought of that one, but someone might do a PhD on that maybe and find out. But it's, I mean, to me, yeah, like, I mean, certainly genetics does play parts in, you know, size and things like that. But yeah, to your point, the, like, to me, the most impressive part is, like, some of those big guys are incredibly skillful as well. That's, like, so it's not, you know, they don't just have the physical attributes. They've got the nuances that they need in rugby, and they've also got skills, like, you know, they're throwing offloads and they're able to, like, read the game. And on the opposite end of that, some of the small guys are, like, you can definitely can't underestimate size in rugby, because some of the smallest players in the world recently have been some of the best. And I think that's, like, quite cool that I think even within the sport, there's a level of respect between positions that, you know, you can be the best player in the world and you're like, yeah, but there's some things I can't do just because it's so position specific. Like, and same from, like, a front row, like, they can scrummage, whereas, like, they're like, okay, I can't do things that somebody further out in the field can do. So there's just quite a good level of respect, I think, across different positions.
How did you periodize the training? I mean, was it force plates? Was it, I don't know, tendo units? I mean, were you measuring bar speed, plyometrics? I'm just wondering, like, as you arrange the training, because, you know, it is so highly skill-based that it's not like, you know, like, football is, it's kind of interesting in that, like, I broke my leg. Like, I took a helmet to the shin, and I think it was in my third or fourth year, and broke my fibula clean in half. And they told me that's a non-weight bearing bone. You don't need that bone to play football. So they casted me 5 days, and I played 3 weeks later on a broken leg. Played 17 weeks like that, and I couldn't run. And I remember telling the coach, I'm like, I just physically can't run. It's still moving. There's a lot of pain. I can't run. And he was like, no, I just need you to do what you do. And I ended up playing pretty well. But I didn't practice during the week. So I kind of, like, rested. I did walkthroughs, but I didn't really do, and I was fine because, you know, like, the fit, like, the physicality, the strength, I mean, all those things. So, you know, once you develop the skill, but when I look at those guys, At least, you know, just kind of going through. I mean, the skill demand and the ability to move, and especially working with the teams as much as they did, I was kind of blown away. Like looking at how do you design training programs that allow them to stay healthy but still measure? I mean, with this much kind of varied volume.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Firstly, I think the organization that we were in, we sort of had an expectation anyway that we're like, okay, well, you know, we want to make sure we're in a position to compete for, I guess, like trophies. So you can sort of block out certain parts of the season. So, I mean, I say that like we've got preseason, in season is the two easiest ways to like denominate. But even within a season, you know, there's certain games. So in rugby in Europe anyway, there's like a sort of domestic competition and then there's like a European one. And for the club that I was in Leinster anyway, both were equally as important, of course. You want to win both. But the European Championship obviously brings a level of like, I guess you get to compete against teams across the whole of Europe, like in France and stuff that you don't play in the domestic league. So that competition for us was certainly of really high importance. So we were able to, I guess, like periodize around sort of trying to peak at those weeks. You know, so we might, even if we're playing a really strong team in a different competition, we're going to go, okay, well, we've got European competition coming up in a few weeks. They're the weeks that we're going to try peak for. Irish Rugby also have a really good like player management system where their international players are capped in terms of the number of minutes they can play throughout a season. And that's because, I mean, it is a long season. So they play, you know, you're playing club, European and international rugby. It's tough. And every sport is tough in its own right. But Irish Rugby have that system in place. So what that does is, one, hopefully keep players fresh for, you know, we say like the business end of the season where you're hopefully competing in knockout stages. But it also means that you're forced to rotate your squad. And so when some players are rested, other players are brought into play. And what that brings is like sort of weeks where we can forecast, okay, this player is going to play for 2-3 weeks in a row and then they're going to have a down week. And that just sort of, we sort of work with the coaches to try and navigate their like periodization around that or their planning. So, you know, that it sort of helps to have that sort of system in place. I think that the performance coaches and strength conditioning staff are so well aligned and related to the medical and the rugby coaches as well. And so as well as that system, that's a very quick synopsis of a more complex system than that. But on top of that, you know, we'll do our own physical profiling, obviously every preseason, but, you know, we'll just try to identify gaps within an individual athlete. So one, are they at a sort of a positional standard for each of those, whether it's like strength, whether it's, you know, reactive strength, whether it's aerobic fitness or the other key attributes. And if they're sort of, if that's an attribute that they're missing, or we think that's below where they should be for their position, that might be an area that we target more. And, you know, if that is strength and it's potentially being impacted by the amount of running or the amount of game minutes, you know, they're the conversations, I think, as a multidisciplinary staff, you've got to have to say, okay, well, like, we've got to think about this athlete like long term. If he's going to be playing, you know, in those European games and internationally, we need a block of time now to dedicate to get him, you know, to address his strength deficiencies or his left right balance or whatever it is. So it's always like a moving piece. And I think like periodization for me is that it's like adjusting your training to, you know, what's needed. You've still got a medium to long term goal in mind, but just trying to be like agile in your approach and trying to make sure that you're just trying to address the right things. And even when I worked in soccer in the UK, you know, we sort of had this concept or conversation with athletes and coaches to say, okay, every athlete's going to have their sword and their Achilles heel. And for us, we want to sharpen their sword. So if they have a super strength, if they're incredibly quick, let's keep that. That's their super strength. That's their sword. But if they're, for example, if their aerobic fitness is like terrible, that's potentially their Achilles heel. So how can we, you know, both maintain the sword and sharpen the sword, but also just protect the Achilles heel? And that, I think, as a concept, is an interesting one for athletes just to kind of take away.
No, that's an incredible analogy. I always use the term wheelhouse. Like, you got to figure out what your wheelhouse is and then stay in your wheelhouse, but, you know, also be able to train up some of those weaknesses. So at the end of the day, like as an athlete, you have to know exactly who you are and what you do well and lean on that. And I was never a fan of like, oh, you should just train all your weaknesses. And I'm like, yeah, but never at the expense of your strength. If you're a fast dude, try to be faster, you know, bring up the other stuff, but don't just rely upon that. But I do like sword and Achilles heel. You brought up soccer. How much of a transition was that moving from, you know, rugby, which is a, like, I, what's the analogy? Rugby is a thug's game played by gentlemen, whereas soccer is a gentleman's game played. No, I forgot how the analogy works, but, you know, you have a game where, you know, not only big, strong dudes trying to, you know, lay a hurt on those guys versus soccer where, you know, all of a sudden you see these guys just, you know, flailing about and, you know, one guy gets touched and, you know, the dramaticism of soccer is pretty interesting. And, you know, I mean, obviously physically demanding, but not physical in the same way that rugby is.
Yeah. Yeah. It was definitely a change. And I think like the biggest change for me, I went from a club organization in rugby to an international organization. And so the biggest change was really, we've got to prepare these athletes for international competition in a much smaller window of time than we usually have with a club. So, you know, with an NC rugby or a club rugby team, you're with them for the whole preseason, the whole way through the season. And they sort of go to an international camp for a couple of weeks throughout the year. But when I moved to England, I was on the other side of that. And so that was probably the biggest difference for me, like personally. And I think the biggest difference and challenge. Now, it helped that when I was in rugby, we had a very good relationship with the international setup. And so all of the conversations that I was having in that situation. So when we were sending players to international, obviously you're having conversations, you're passing over information, you're trying to make the transition for the player as easy as possible. So I was just on the other end of that conversation this time. The other part, I guess, as well, was when I moved to England, I worked in men's rugby in Ireland, but I worked across men's and women's teams in England. And so even there were some differences just in approaches and everything else. And but honestly, some of the female athletes I worked with were amazing. They do anything to improve, like physically. You know, they literally would run through a brick wall if they thought, okay, this is going to help my performance. And that was really amazing to see just like how quickly and how much the women's game had grown in soccer. So I think they're probably the two like biggest differences for me, but certainly is challenging because in international football or soccer, you can have a tournament where you play three games in 7 days. And so trying to turn around and like, that's where I guess the recovery piece became, not, I wouldn't say even more important, but it was so apparent for athletes that they had to recover so quickly to play at an international level 2 days later.
Hold on. Oh, there we go. Cut out on me a second. Is size a factor? I mean, obviously soccer guys are dramatically smaller than, let's say, the bigger rugby guys, but maybe comparable. I mean, if you look at a rugby guy, like, you can kind of pick them out, usually a little more muscled up just because they have to, if you think about armor and impacts and all that, whereas the soccer guys tend to be, you know, much more slender and, you know, be able to run a lot longer. You know, is that like, I don't know, as you start kind of periodizing and working in strength, like being able to make sure that these guys are strong and fit, but like not put on too much size. Cause I feel like you rarely do you see a soccer dude that's like, you know, 220 pounds and pretty jacked.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I just don't think they need to carry as much mass. Some soccer athletes are incredibly strong, like relative strength. So I don't want to, you know, when we're sharing this or having this conversation, I don't want to like diminish how athletic a lot of those athletes are. Like,
no, soccer is extremely athletic. I just think that they're a bunch of huge pussies. Every time I watch it, it's like the dramaticism of some of these dudes, like they get hit and they're like laying out there. I mean, it's just, it's funny. I mean, I know it's the sport, but it's, maybe it's part of it coming from American football where you see it and you're like, but you know, there is no denying the skill that these guys have in terms of their ability. I mean, just watching like, what's his name? Oh, dude, the guy from Argentina, Messi, his control of the ball and some of the kicks. I mean, it's unbelievable. Like the precision and marksmanship, like that these guys are able to do. Like I was watching some of the trick shots that, you know, and they're like, this thing's 60 yards away and Messi's dropping it in the trash can, like 10 out of 10. I mean, just the, like the amount of time. And I never really understood it until we went to Brazil and we were in Rio and we were walking down the street and there was like 60 kids playing like in this, like between two buildings. They had a net and they were playing with this little ball like futsal. And these kids were playing this game off the wall jumping. I mean, it's probably one of the more insane things I've ever seen. Yeah. But like, that's the game that those kids played in Brazil. And then all of a sudden they get out on a big field and it's like, this feels easy.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, on the like diving and stuff, I don't want to say it's like part of the game, but I do think the value of getting a penalty in soccer is so big, or even a free kick or a set play. And that's where, like, you know, soccer teams have like set play coaches, like specifically for like how to navigate a corner or free kick and stuff towards goal. So like those opportunities are so valuable. So certainly when you're like working and you're in the environment, you can see, it's not to say like you're telling, you know, it's like, oh, everyone go dive and stuff, but you can see the value of like getting in those situations. On the size thing, certainly the training methods towards you know, not increasing muscle mass too much, but still increasing strength. You know, so you might orient a little bit away from sort of higher volume or higher density sort of resistance training, just because they still need muscle and strength. So, but just not as much as like NFL, rugby, other sports. And the aerobic system is so taxed. I mean, because there's so much running in soccer that I don't say that's a key element, but that is sort of one of those. There's a little bit of positional variance as well. You'll see potentially some defenders needing a little bit more strength, let's say, to hold off some attackers. So typically you'll see some of the bigger guys, maybe sort of central defenders, central midfielders, and then goalkeepers as well are obviously like a very different position. So typically their training will be very different. They still need, like to your point at the start of this conversation, they still need a good aerobic system because they've got to stay energized, alert, and they've got to be really powerful for 90 minutes plus longer. And they do that across a week as well. But certainly their training, you know, they can maybe afford to do a little bit more like strength and power work and make sure that they're powerful so they can dive and like, you know, be strong and be physically present in some of those like set piece situations. But yeah, certainly more of a running component and relative strength aspect than absolute sort of like mass needed.
How'd you feel about being Irish living in the UK or living in England?
Yeah, I got a bit of slag in the rugby team when that happened. There was a player as well who an Irish, well, he's English, but who had played in Ireland and stuff and moved to England and was capped by the English team. And so I was getting called his name a couple of times in the team that I was in as a bit of a slagging. But no, there's so many Irish in England, honestly. I know it's almost like a bit of a joke now, but it's no, the relationships were always
Well,
good.
there's a awesome clip of what's his name? Killian, the actor, the guy
Oh,
that
Killian
did,
Murphy.
where he was like the I think it was like there was somebody in the royal family, like one of the Harry or William, whatever it is, and they're like going through and they're meeting, these actors, and the look on his face is so priceless. Understanding like the politics and like the history of like the English versus the Irish. And it's pretty telling, like looking at that, and you could just see like the amount of like disdain, disgust, and like you just awesome clip if you ever find it. And so I always wonder when the Irish go. So no, I mean I've been to both places. I would definitely have given the opportunity to live in Ireland. I thought I loved it there. My family came from Ireland, or part of my family came from Ireland, went to Western Canada, and then the other part was some English, went to Western Canada. So that's kind of how we got. But when we taught a number of seminars, not only in Ireland, but also even a weirder deal is we taught in Northern Ireland, and got a chance to go up and understand that dynamic, which was extremely interesting. So we were in Belfast for St. Patrick's Day. I mean, I've had a great opportunity to travel and teach seminars when I worked for CrossFit. We taught seminars all around the globe, so I got a really cool chance to kind of see it on a ground level. So then, what got? I mean, I know you since have taken another job, but what was did you have a great experience and you just wanted to go do something else and venture out? And how did all that work?
Yeah, just I guess I've always just been curious. I probably have too many interests in the sort of like health and performance world that you know, like even moving from rugby, like that was sort of my main sport, I guess, in high school. I had a lot of friends that, you know, played in the team that I was working for and a lot of friends in that circle, but I always just thought like, oh, it'd be cool to work in a different sport or in a different place, a different industry. So even moving across to soccer in the UK was just like, I guess part of that, just me trying to see like, oh, what's all this about and stuff. So yeah, moving to Vancouver in an industry role now, slightly different, and still get the opportunity to work with athletes outside of that as well, within the role, but also outside of that as well, which is cool because that at the end of the day, I'm still a coach, as much as I am a researcher, a sports scientist, or whatever title you want to put beside my name. You know, at the end of the day, still want to try support people, athletes, and so yeah, it's definitely open my eyes. And I think over the last couple of years, it's been interesting to see whether it's getting older or just you know, endurance sports, I guess, have probably become a lot more, I don't know, I'm going to say more popular, but I think they've always been popular. But it seems like a lot more people in my circles and stuff are trying their hand in endurance sports. So it's always fascinating to see that. And maybe it's just, again, people's awareness of the benefits of aerobic fitness towards health and stuff, that, you know, people still want to be competitive. So maybe it's like people are putting their hand up to say, okay, like, I understand the benefits of aerobic fitness and cardiovascular fitness, but I still want to compete. So let me try compete in some of those sports. So that's been pretty interesting to experience.
Well, I also feel like you can develop aerobic fitness for much longer in life. Like, for example, some of the people that are the most competitive, if you look at like the triathlons, like we had the guy from USA Triathlon on the podcast, and he was talking about for those sprint tries, the, you know, the sweet spot's 18 to 24. But once they start going out to like the longer, you know, like Kona Ironman stuff, like most of those guys peak in their 30s and 40s, just because it takes an incredible amount of effort and time and just this to develop the aerobic capacity to go. And he's like, it's something that you can develop where, you know, strength and speed and power output, there's kind of a peak level. Like there's a certain age where you tend to peak. And even for me, I go back and think, you know, I think I squatted like 610 when I was 19. I benched 500 when I was 22. And when I was 26, you know, I benched, you know, 535 for a triple. And like my strength kind of peaked right in like my late 20s and, you know, still maybe into my 30s. But there was definitely like, you know, now in my 40s, I just hope that I can be within 80% of all that stuff, you know? Whereas I feel like for the aerobic stuff, I mean, you can continue to develop that for such a long period of time. And you look at the guys that are extremely dominant, it's usually pretty, you know, some of the older athletes.
Definitely, yeah. But yeah, particularly like you said, for those longer events, I just think also seeing some Ironman athletes, triathletes in the flesh, they're people think that they're like running, cycling, swimming really slowly over that, they're still going so fast.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Compared to what probably I'd run myself as well, I'm like, no, these, like, they're going quick, they're moving really, really fast. And so I think that's even more impressive, that they're not only doing these like insane distances and they're enduring for so long, but they're actually just doing it really, really quickly as well.
Well, the guy that trains the sprint US Olympic team, his comment was that every one of the people that are on their Olympic squad could be on the Olympics for any one of the solo events. So whether it be running, be swimming, I mean, everybody has obviously their kind of deal, but he's like, you know, these guys were all Olympic athletes at this. They just decided to like combine these three to give them a unique chance. So, I mean, you know, they're running, I mean, like, you know, like just insane 5K and 10K times, you know, to the point where it's Olympic caliber stuff. Is there things that you've taken from obviously rugby and soccer and training professional athletes that have kind of trickled down and, you know, allowed you to, you know, change the lens, or more importantly, train more, I guess you could say, general pop, or, you know, not very specialized athletes, but what things could kind of trickle down into those kind of everyday athletes?
100%. There's so much. And I think there's like, this goes both ways as well, but I think just the one, I mean, professional athletes have a high training volume, and they're obviously paid to do that. That's their job. But I think that's one thing that, you know, people sort of forget about. If you do the work, you'll adapt and become fitter or stronger, or whatever the sort of whatever training you're aiming towards. So that's the one thing. But the second thing is the consistency that these athletes in rugby, soccer, across, you know, they're putting in consistent training year on year. And that's what's making them so fit or strong or athletic or powerful or whatever attribute that people are wanting. So I think sometimes a lot of general population think that they see like one exercise and go, okay, I'll do that, and that's going to make me as powerful as this athlete. But they forget that often it's, you know, you've got to get training volume right, i.e. do enough work, and then you've got to be consistent enough over months and years instead of days and weeks. So they're probably the two things that I even think professional athletes take for granted, that it's just part of their schedule. It's almost just built into, like, I think even now you spoke, like, if you retired as an athlete, but you, like, training is just embedded into part of your day now. And that's probably something that maybe isn't true. And I think what a lot of people can learn from elite or professional athletes is like, it's part of the day. And I think that goes not just for training, but it's also for sleep and recovery and all those other aspects that, I think if you're an athlete, you eat well. Like, that's just part of, you know, it's been embedded in you for years that after you do a tough session, you need a good food after to replenish and recover.
You would hope so. Unfortunately, I played with guys in the NFL that drank Cokes, ate chicken McNuggets and Skittles, and like some of the guys, like I remember, like, so this is what's wild in the NFL. There is such a genetic lottery winning that these guys are doing everything in spite of what they should. Like, I mean, it's crazy. They're there in spite. Like I played, you know, the DJ Metcalf, you know, it was like this physical specimen NFL player. I mean, he like wakes up, has a coffee, eats some Skittles, like pretty much eats candy, has like one meal. And the dude's like 230, 240, 50 pounds of just shredded out. I mean, I watched Al Harris, who was our DB. I watched him drink two large Cokes and eat chicken McNuggets. And we were, you know, during practice, it was hot that day. It was like 100 degrees. He was so lean that he had like a full body cramp, and they were in there, you know, he's cramping, they're giving him IVs. It was like cramping with striations, to the point where I was like, this dude's probably somewhere around 4 or 5% body fat. He loses a few pounds of water and he's fucked. But he was shredded. And I'm thinking to myself, dude, I've seen this guy eat nothing but chicken McNuggets and just bullshit. And, you know, I mean, you can't do that forever. And that's why a lot of those guys tend to be, you know, when they stop playing, they balloon up and get diabetes and have a lot of physical issues just because they've been so gifted for so long that it didn't really matter. Like the only way they weren't going to make it to the NFL, they got hit by a bus. But I know for me, you know, training was always important. Like I had to pretty much have everything on task to be there. Whereas other guys were like, I've been training 6 months and still go bow and bench 500 pounds, which is the shit that just blew my mind. But, the NFL is a land of genetic freaks. Whereas I think for a lot of these other sports, there's nowhere to hide. Like you cannot not do the work in rugby just because like the physical demands are so much, like you're not going to, you know, whereas I mean, soccer, the same thing. I mean, the skill development, the ability to be able to run and move just by the sheer magnitude of the field, like you have to be in shape. Whereas, yeah. It wasn't always like that. So I, you know, and then also the time domain, you know, 5 to 7 seconds. Now, if you took football and you said, okay, it's gonna be 5 to 7 seconds, but you got to start jogging in between plays. So you couldn't stand there and rest and get TV timeouts and do all the things. But the other issue too in American football is I always broke people. Not this was an analogy that was given to me later on, but it made a lot of sense. There's two types of athletes, or what we call big monkeys and small monkeys. And the big monkeys could handle a ton of volume. You know, I was a big monkey. I could lift weights 6 days a week and practice, and just like the more I did, the more I seemed to be to get better. Whereas I played with other guys that the volume was so much that they could never recover. Like my roommate in college. He was, you know, coming into college, he was a 400-pound bencher and a 500-pound squatter at like 17, and he trained 3 days a week. And then all of a sudden, you know, we show up and we got to train 6 days a week. And every single year, he got progressively weaker. By the time he was a senior, he barely benched 300 pounds. And I remember being like, Doe, like, how, his name is Kevin Doherty. I was like, Doe, like, how are you getting weaker? He's like, it's too much. Like, I physically cannot do this all the time. Whereas for me, it was like the more we did, the better I got. And so I think for certain sports, and I saw this a lot for different positions, like, for example, you know, a guy like Tom Brady, right? Like they had a guy whose entire job was to count every rep that Tom Brady threw. So anytime he threw the ball, the guy would go click. And he had an exact amount of throws that he had in his shoulder that he knew. And they managed volumes, whereas you look like a guy like Patrick Mahomes, they don't even probably count his reps. That guy probably throws like 300-400 times in a day. I mean, he can throw the ball as much as he wants and his arm just seems to get better. Other guys, they have to really monitor. And there were, you know, certain guys at certain positions, you know, they, you know, this guy's going to get 10 max efforts. This guy can run all day. And it's not to say one was better than the other, because all that really mattered was, you know, whatever you have to do to perform on that Sunday. But I mean, we used to, you know, have short turnarounds. Like for example, you know, you play on a Sunday, then you have a Thursday night game. So the turnaround was cut in half. And there were guys that like couldn't practice that week because they just weren't physically recovered. Whereas I was like, man, we could probably do this a bunch. Like, you know, training camp, my first year in training camp, we were in training camp 42 days, which was double days. You go pads in the morning, pads in the afternoon, pads in the morning, and then you get a day off with special teams practice. And like, you know, I was fine. Other guys were just like shattering like glass. And then years later, I had a cool conversation with Dr. Nicholas Romanoff, a Russian sports scientist, the inventor of POSE. And I asked him, like, why is it that, you know, certain athletes, like not everybody responds to volume and this. And he you know, he basically gave him this analogy for, you know, big monkeys and small monkeys. Like, mm-hmm. he's like, in the jungle, you see there's certain monkeys that are just only move enough to eat. And there's others that play and fight and battle. And they're just so active. He's like, one's not better than the other. But he's like, there's definitely some inherent energy expenditures. And his theory was that a lot of that stems from early adaptations. So like the sooner an athlete, like, I mean, just the skill development for Stocker, like looking at what those guys are able to do. I mean, the only way you have that level of precision is by, as a kid, you didn't do anything other than walk around with a soccer ball and play soccer, you know, 7 days a week for hours upon hours. You know?
Yeah. I think what you highlighted there is just like how individual training is, like that you can't just copy paste the same program across, even within a squad, but across different sports. And, you know, even if we were talking earlier, obviously, about like, oh, general population learning from elites, like they probably can't copy and paste that program. One, they may not be able to tolerate that intensity or training volume, but they also might be a completely different type of athlete. And like, you know, if it's big monkey, small monkeys, or like some fast twitch dominant athletes can, you know, maybe they don't tolerate volume as much. They just need more quality reps, but they still get the same outcome and stuff. So I think the point that you just highlighted is like very much to me that training is completely individual. And like, even to connect something we spoke about earlier is like using some of these feedback loops, whether it's like wearables or strength measures, or like they're the ways that you can assess your progress and how effective your training is. So if, for example, if it's grip strength or counter movement jump, if you see that you're not making progress over a couple of weeks or a couple of months, like you've got to investigate what the reasons for that are. Maybe is it I'm doing too much training or not enough training? Is it because I'm not recovering well enough? Is it because my program isn't targeting the right thing? So that's like, if Barty brings back the point, like that's where I think you need coaches in the world to be able to like take the step back from, you know, as an athlete, you can get caught up in like this number, oh, like this has to be bigger, better, faster. But as a coach, you have the ability to like step back and review like multiple different things. And so, interesting enough, maybe that was your plan, just to like actually connect a few things you talked about.
Yeah,
like,
no, I train two of the top jiu-jitsu players in the world. Victor Hugo is the ultra, and then, you know, Philippe Costa is a heavyweight. And these kids are in their mid-early 20s and are absolute rubber. Like I am amazed at not only the volume they train with. You know, they roll from anywhere from, you know, 1 to 3 times a day. They come train with me. I mean, they might have, I mean, it might be anywhere from like on consistent like 16 to 24 training sessions in a week. And I mean, these are, you know, on the mat, maybe, you know, 90 minutes, 60 minutes. I mean, then in the gym with us, I try to get everything done in like 60, 70 minutes. You know, we do kind of every other day, full body, you know, one's a max effort. They do a lot of, you know, a lot of speed, a lot of plyometrics. But what's crazy is I have to almost monitor, and I use the analogy of the Christmas tree. And I think a lot of strength coaches do, like, you know, your first year when you get a Christmas tree, you move into your house, you put up a Christmas tree, you might have a few ornaments and it looks pretty good. Maybe then the next year you get a few more. Like 10 years down the road, it looks like your mom's Christmas tree with 400 ornaments. And there's just too much on there. And I think that's like the training analogy I run into with a lot of coaches, is they just keep hanging movements and this, and we're going to do this. And I constantly, like, as I lay out the training, I kind of like put it away and I look back, and then I kind of go back and monitor and be like, oh, it's too much. We'll get to this eventually. And then when we get into the training, all of a sudden I look at the clock, I look at the quality of the movement, you know, and it's like, hey, if this is the rep range we're going to hit, how many sets are we going to get there? Well, it depends on how fast we get there and how well it's moving. But it's because I see these guys and then I train with them. And, you know, one of the things I always ask is, how are you feeling? How's the recovery? Have you eaten enough? What did last night's sleep? And you just basically just, you know, put them on the bike for 5 minutes and I can get all the information I know. And I know how to periodize the training. But like when you follow a set program, there's no variation because you're not actually seeing these athletes. But I'm forever amazed. But I also have to remember that these kids, I call them kids because they're younger than me. But, you know, they started doing jits in Brazil, you know, as kids. And all they did was go to school and do jiu-jitsu and roll. So this is all they've ever known. This is what they've done. This is their passion. So they have built all those, you know, metabolic pathways for volume and this. I mean, this is what they do. And they're so efficient that, you know, when I go roll with them, I feel like I'm drowning in water. And these guys are just, you know, so surgical in what they do. It's really interesting to see people at like kind of that high level of mastery where, you know, I'm drenched and they haven't even broken a sweat because they're so efficient in what they do. But it's really been an interesting opportunity because those are guys that I don't necessarily work with. So I'm always excited to work with people that I just are outside of my scope of expertise.
I mean, they're, if you want to talk about like strength at all, they're guys that have insane relative strength, and probably even not in the true sense of, you know, if you're measuring like squat numbers or other things, like they may also have that. Those guys are a true example of like relative strength, like how strong they are. Like they might not be the biggest guys in terms of stature or like muscle mass, but like, yeah, if you roll around in a mat with them, you're
So Victor is 6'4", 260. The first day he came in and trained with us, he had an L4, L5 injury, and that was pretty debilitating. 165 pounds on a back squat for a set of five. And, you know, it wasn't because he wasn't strong. It just was the axial loading was shutting him down, and, you know, he was having inhibition from pain. So then the whole deal was getting him, you know, strong away from axial loading. And then once we've got him real strong, we could add it back in. Like it's a weird deal to roll with these guys because I know exactly how strong they are in the weight room. I've trained with them. I lift with them. I know what it is and I know how strong I am. And to feel not only like the consistent isometric strength and the pressure and the pulls, but also like the efficiency of joint angles. That's the one that really is like constantly amazes me, that all of a sudden they get into like one position and they know that like if they rotate with the thumb up and they keep the elbow glued to the rib cage, like their ability to pull is dramatic. So they know it within like, you know, the like within this kind of grappling sense. But then when we go into the gym, they'll like, you know, do some just stupid shit and I'll be like, dude, like you wouldn't do that this way. And so like basically being able to kind of connect those pieces, but then also they, like this was another one, like movements that we would typically do in the gym where I would assess athleticism, like let's say it was a box jump or jumping over something, or just, you know, like I'm sure you've seen this where, you know, somebody does something like, whether it's like, hey, jog across the field, he puts his foot in the ground and just kind of takes off, or, you know, makes a move where you're like, damn, that was really like, he moves really well. He has a great like awareness. So to see these guys in the gym and not have that same thing where they look like athletes, but then all of a sudden put them on a jiu-jitsu mat and watch them do, you know, 260-pound guy do a single arm cartwheel over a guy into a back take and think like, Jesus, like where's that athleticism in the weight room? And then realizing that like the paradigm of training, especially growing up as a, you know, like when I started training in like football and weight room, like they were so like integral, like you lift weights, the bridge to the weight room and the field comes from a lot of the plyos and the jumps and a lot of just the training we do. And then you go out and you train. So there was this system married, but for these guys, especially in the JITS world, strength training was not really a piece of it. So when these guys had come to me and their coach approached me about working with them, he's like, oh, they're pro athletes. They've lifted weights. It was apparent within 5 minutes that they had never lifted weights. Like they might've gone to a gym that had weights, but I don't know what the fuck they did because it wasn't training as way that we would define training. And so
I think what you're like speaking about is like at highest how I think about like strength, and like strength is task specific, which is important for us to like to share it. And that like, even so, we obviously have measures or proxies of strength to sort of suggest, you know, okay, this player is like strong or fast, but like strength is task specific. And, you know, the things we're doing in the gym are really, we're trying to increase the amount of force that someone can produce, the rate that they can produce that force, and then the direction. And like those things obviously can directly translate to some people or actions and then less so. So like to me, like in the jiu-jitsu example, like some of these gym exercises are like, they're addressing weaknesses potentially, or like deficits that, you know, maybe they're not getting directly through their sport and stuff. And I think that's always been the way that like I've approached, or we've approached it, is that, you know, like how can we use the gym to like, one, develop just like general strength, muscle mass, you know, like chase some tissue adaptation, but also like, are there things that this player needs or this athlete needs that they're not getting directly from the sport, which is always really interesting. But yeah, certainly like even in rugby positions or in football or just in any sport. Like they're so strong in their sport. And then, you know, some exercises in the gym just don't relate, or like you just don't see that same level of like coordination and strength.
This has been my Neo Matrix. Like this is like the seed, you know, when he talks about the matrix, like this splinter in his mind, where I used to watch guys that were extremely gifted and very strong and dynamic in the weight room, but yet were awful on the field. They couldn't play dead. I saw other guys that were gifted on the field, moved, could generate power and were strong, and then they go in the weight room and like it was like confusing. And so for me, I was always, for every pound of strength that I was able to gain in the weight room, I was able to apply it, you know, x-fold on the field. So like my squat went up, I ran faster, right to the point I didn't, and then I had to figure out why. But like, you know, as my skill stronger, my bench, my ability to generate force. And it really came back to, and you know, when people ask me, they're like, oh, you know, like what thing could you point to? When I was 14, the old power lifter that trained me, like it was kind of interesting. I wanted to lift weights. My dad said lifting weights was for idiots. It was just counting to 10 over and over again, and morons could do it. So I started, you know, lifting weights at football. And then there was an old power lifter that lived in our neighborhood, and he trained in his garage, and he would invite, you know, certain guys that were pretty good football players because he wanted training partners. He was in his 50s and was still training. And he figured like, hey, I'll get these kids real strong and they'll be good training partners. So I got invited to come train with them. And he was friends with Fred Hatfield, you know, Dr. Squad, who's since passed away, rest in peace. But one of Fred Hatfield's principles was compensatory acceleration. As mechanical advantage increases, so does speed. So, you know, when George would talk about lifting weights, like as you bring the bar off your chest, as you, you know, most people kind of slow the bar down, I want you to continue to drive the bar, and I want you to try to speed the weight. As mechanical advantage increases, so does the speed of the movement. So I use the squat, deadlift, everything, to the point where he's like, I want you to try to break the weights. If somebody sees you lift weights, I want them to come over and be like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm trying to break these motherfuckers. So that was how we were coached. And then all of a sudden, when I went on the field, you know, everything from, you know, running and hitting and punching, whatever it looked like, was I was always trying to increase speed as mechanical advantage. Like as I was full extension to hit a guy, I was trying to drive through him, not just hit him. And that training, like piece in that training at 14 or 15 when I was, all of a sudden, I think allowed me to develop a certain skill set that allowed me to, you know, play 10 years in the NFL as, you know, maybe not as physically gifted maybe as some of the other people, but like that piece was like my weapon of choice. So when, you know, guys didn't want to go against me because when I punched, I wasn't trying to punch them. I was trying to put my hands through them and then, you know, come out the other side. So I wasn't just trying to hit people. I was trying to fucking shatter chests and break heads, and because my hands were going to go through. So the interesting thing for like, you know, with jiu-jitsu, there's a lot of, you know, positions and flexibility, and there's like a lot of this movement. But I think the one thing that's been neat, or rad, however you want to say it, is to take what those guys do and then give them some of that like American horsepower, like I'm going to try to fuck people up and now we smash. So it's been a really interesting to kind of like take that different approach. Like now you're just not trying to just submit somebody, you're trying to punish them a little bit. And that's where it's been kind of neat. And it's just been extremely eye-opening. I think, like you said, you know, you went from rugby, you went to soccer. I think training different athletes and seeing what you've learned and how it applies is really how you push yourself as a coach or, you know, educator or scientist, whatever it is. And then being able to have really good people around you, you reach out and pull out different modalities. Like we started using force plates with the guys and some of the other stuff. We're going to start doing a bunch of lactate testing. We had a guy on the podcast for that. So just being able to pull some of this off and just understand who they are as athletes and then fine tuning the training to allow them to progress to a high level.
That, like 100%. I was just about to say the same thing. Like when I moved to soccer, there were things that I learned and I'm like, oh, like I would have done this so differently if I had had this experience before rugby. Not to say we're doing things terribly, but like there were just other tools in my toolbox as like a practitioner. You're like, oh, there are different ways to approach this. Say now in endurance, there are things that across endurance, different team sports that you pick up that, you know, you just develop, like as a practitioner, you develop a toolbox that's more complete. And so whether that's like, you know, if I went back 10 years and worked in rugby again, okay, are there different, would I be monitoring different things? Well, maybe I would have added in a couple of different things or changed something. Would I have approached training slightly differently? Maybe. Would they have made any difference? I don't know. But certainly just my thought process, I think, just have evolved over a couple of years that, yeah, being able to work with different athletes, even male, female, seeing differences between sports, different training ages from under 18s up to 30-year-olds and seniors and senior professionals. There are just things that I think you can take as a practitioner from all of those, but also as an athlete, you can learn from people who are younger than you, or you can learn from people in different sports than you. I think it's cool about some like podcasts and even just online platforms and stuff. Now there are, athletes can see different things and hopefully not, think, oh, this one exercise is going to solve all my problems, but hopefully it creates a level of curiosity. They can go to their coach and say, hey, like I listened to this podcast and I heard people talking about if it is lactate testing, like, is that useful for me? And then maybe as a coach, you're like, look, it's not something you have to worry about, but it might be like, yeah, actually, you know what? If you're interested, let's do it and let's see how it can help evolve your training or it can help improve your recovery and stuff. So I think that's like, people say that there's negatives and positives to social media and whatever else. Like, that's certainly one of the positives, I think, from an athletic standpoint, is that people are just seeing different athletic feats and exercises and training modalities that they probably didn't see a couple of years ago.
I could not agree more. As much as I shit on social media, and I do, because I think it's vapid and, but I also think, your ability to see people do things like, so I'll just give you like a example. Like when I went to go play high school football, and one of the guys who was older than me was a pretty good high school football player. So he got a lot of recruiting. And so when they showed up to the recruiting stuff, I was, 6'4" at the time, like 250 pounds. I think I grew 2 inches in college. So I was, obviously, kind of a little bit of a late bloomer, but they showed up and this guy was a pretty good football player. So then I start getting recruited. And then the guy that I played guard, which is next to the center. And then the tackle was a big dude and he got recruited. And so we had a lot of like interest. And then I ended up getting a scholarship. So when they, I had a bunch of scholarship offers, looked at a bunch of schools, and never thinking about playing in the NFL. I was just excited, like, oh man, they're going to pay for my school and I'm going to get to go to a university that there was no way I was going to get into grade wise. I ended up going to Berkeley, and like the valedictorian of my high school didn't get into it. So I go there and I think I hadn't really thought past it. Like, hey, I'm going to go get an education and I'm going to kick ass from there. And then all of a sudden, I come in, I redshirt, I'm on the scout team. And I'm, battling these dudes and like getting my ass kicked, but not as much as I should have, and was handling these guys decently. That next year, both of those guys were top 10 picks in the NFL, and they came in as rookies and were killing people. And I'm looking at this and I'm like, dude, I was on the scout team playing against these guys. Now, obviously it wasn't game time, so, the level of intensity, but these dudes were bringing it. And that was all of a sudden when you realize, like, oh, if these guys are playing at a high level and I was able to play against them, this is something I potentially could do. So then all of a sudden you go out and end up getting drafted and show up and, ended up coming and started as a rookie and playing for another decade. And it wasn't something that was on my radar. Like, it wasn't like I was 6 years old and like, one day I'm going to play in the NFL. Like, I didn't even know what that was. So, the training space, and this is hilarious. The reason I really wanted to go play football is I wanted to lift weights. I just wanted to be big and strong. Like, my brothers were all big and strong. Like, everybody I saw that, like, every, movie that we ever saw, all the dudes, all the superheroes, or all the stars were always, like big, strong dudes. And I think that was something that I was into. And I was like, well, those guys play football. They get to lift weights. They all look like big, strong dudes. My brothers play football. I guess I'll go play. But it wasn't something that, I developed from a young age. And I think that's what's kind of fascinating a little bit about American football is, I played with guys that, Steve Neal never even played football, was an All-American wrestler, missed the Olympic trials, goes and tries out and ends up having, playing for the Patriots and getting Super Bowl rings. There was, different tight ends that had played, basketball. So there was a lot of skills that were developed away from football that allowed these guys to play this game. So whenever people ask me about playing football, I tell them, like, a lot of the skills that I developed, from boxing when I was young and, martial arts and a lot of the things that I did were more beneficial to me than actually playing football. And it wasn't until I was older. So I wonder the skill development stuff. I mean, whereas I think for, sports like soccer and rugby, there's such a high level of skill developed that the only way you're going to develop that is from a young age. And, you know, if you go to any of these countries, whether it be Brazil and you see young kids play, or, you know, going to New Zealand and driving around and just basically seeing rugby pitches everywhere and kids out there playing not only pickup games, but I mean, it's not like here in the US where, you know, you're rarely going to see kids playing a pickup rugby game. You're going to probably see people playing pickup basketball or, you know, some form of, you know, football, tackle football or flag. So it's just, I wonder, it's a skill development piece. You know, but then here in Texas, where we are now, it's actually ridiculous. Like, my daughter is 12 and plays on she's a pretty good basketball player. She plays on a club team. It's like 4 days a week. And like practices, I mean, my son's 8 and he plays baseball. They have a game and like, it's insane the amount of practice and time. And more importantly, like, how serious the parents take it. And my wife's like, why are you more serious about it? I'm like, I don't know, because maybe because I played in the NFL and like I was a pro athlete. So I know that like, as long as they're having fun, they're going to do it. I keep telling my wife, 90% of these kids are never going to play these sports just because they're going to be so burned out. So I wonder if, is that like an American phenomenon, or as you get into some of these other teams, I just wonder if that's as universal as you saw within rugby and soccer, that same thing.
Yeah, I think like you'll see players play them from a young age, but it's not, they're not only playing rugby or soccer, you know, they're also playing maybe basketball, or in Ireland, like Gaelic football or hurling, or like Irish sports that a lot of people will play growing up and stuff. So certainly I think like you need years of experience and skill development within a sport. But I think also to what you're saying as well, like, you know, a rugby athlete would benefit if, you know, if he's played basketball or soccer, or if he's swam or whatever, other sports as well. So I think it's an as well as opposed to an instead of and stuff. But I do think, yeah, for skill-based sports, you need a level of just repetitions and practice, and like, I think like intentional practice within the sport as well, because, you know, you need to develop things. It's not just skills, but it's skills like under pressure or in certain situations and stuff like that as well. And I still think that stands for NFL. I think that's, you know, some of the reasons that some other sport athletes don't make it in the NFL is like, a lot of it's just the nuance and like the understanding and stuff that you have to develop, maybe more so, like you said, in certain positions. But you know, that's definitely evident, I think, across like all sports and even other athletic things. Now, you'll see some people that transition to different sports if, you know, some of the physical characteristics and things are related. But certainly I think like a lot of rugby players or soccer players that get to the top level have been playing since a young age. But I also think, you just mentioned it, is like they've played just because they absolutely love it. Like, then they've had fun. So it hasn't been something that they've had to do. It's something that they've always wanted to do for years. So, you know, you see documentaries now of like top athletes, and, you know, you see videos from or footage from them as a kid, and they're just like kicking a football around, and they just because they absolutely love it. And that's the only thing that they wanted to do. So yeah, definitely it has to come with the like passion and the fun elements as well. So I think that's particularly for younger people. And I think that stands true. I say particularly for younger people. I still think you have to enjoy a sport if you play it at the top end. I don't think you can truly commit to it if you don't actually enjoy it to some degree.
What do you think? I mean, now that you've kind of transitioned out of these kind of, you know, high level pro sports, and you're kind of working in this different kind of general pop kind of environment, like what are the intangibles that you would say for, like, let's say a general pop athlete? I mean, we talked about sleep, we talked about nutrition, aerobic base, lifting weights. I mean, is it as simple as, you know, move something heavy, you know, build a, you know, high level of aerobic conditioning with zone 2, don't eat like an asshole, sleep, you know, if you're deficient in something, take some supplements. I'm just wondering, like, you know, have fun. I mean, all these things that unfortunately everybody knows, but very few people have actually, you know, gravitated to, when, because it's almost it can't be that simple. And I get that pretty often with people.
Mm-hmm. I think like it's all the things you've listed there, we talked about, just putting them into a plan. I remember I spoke to an athlete that I worked with in rugby, and he'd retired when I was still there. But I think a year later or a few months later, you know, I caught up with him. I just saw him, and I was like, oh, how is it, you know, retired, you've moved on? And he was like, the strangest things. He said, one, I really had to focus on putting structure in my day. So he went into like a sort of office or traditional job, I guess, if you want to call it that. And he was like, I just needed to make sure that I put structure on my day. So I needed to like actually plan in my gym sessions, or plan in this, or, you know, even plan in to get like to when to eat or different times. Because, you know, as an athlete, like particularly the place we work, like you'd get a schedule. you know, we might give a plan or a calendar for 4 weeks at a time. Or in England, when we were working internationally, we'd have a full schedule hour by hour for every day on camp. And we'd schedule in even like recovery time, sleep, eating windows, training, gym, all these other things. And I think that's an element that people just maybe take for granted. They think, you know, you have to do all of those things, train hard, recover well, eat well. But like just actually putting it into a sort of a calendar and structuring it within your week or within a couple of weeks, I think that's something that some people just don't do. Making sure you actually put it on paper, I think, or into a calendar, whatever you use, is like definitely an important factor in it all.
Cool. How do people catch up with you on social? I know you got a pretty, I was going through your, doing a little cyber creeping on you. So how do people get a hold of you if they want to know more information?
I'm on, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Probably use Instagram most, these days. But my handle is at Dr. Peter Tierney. So try post some stuff, and honestly, I say this to everybody. I learn probably more from people than they learn from me. I post some stuff that's just early thoughts in a visual or some thoughts, and you know, people give me a lot of feedback. As long as it's constructive, I'm more than happy to take it and, you know, adjust. And I think, you know, some of the visuals that I've created and over the past while, you'll see have like iterated. So, version 4 or version 5 is an evolution of what version 1 is. And that's just because people, peers, other experts who are much smarter than me in certain areas are, you know, commenting and saying like, hey, look, there's actually some new research here that's suggesting this, or like, oh, you've sort of, you know, maybe apply this. So I think that's a really cool part. Like we talked a little bit about social media. Like for me personally, I've found it really useful. I just learned so much from people on different platforms. But yeah, I'm mostly on Instagram, but also on Twitter and LinkedIn.
Cool. Well, dude, thanks for tuning in to Power Athlete Radio. Hey there, Power Athlete Nation. Big shout out to all the heavy hitters who stuck around till the final whistle. If you've been soaking in the knowledge bombs and epic tales you've been dropping for free, here's your chance to be a game changer. Swing by klfi.com/powerathlete and toss a few bucks our way to keep the podcast fueled and firing on all cylinders. That's ko-fi.com/powerathlete. Your support makes a difference. See ya.